This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
This is going to be a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour Big Picture. I would like to take you back over the last 7 or 8 years here on the program and point out that we have floated. I guess if we look at the recovery time starting around 2010, you know, we had the big event 2007, 2008. And by 2010, things were changing. And over these last 8 years or so, we've seen the favorability here on the program floating from various asset classes in the market, favorability of gold to gold, then away from gold and back to gold again. But what we want to do is go back to two articles which Jim Poplava authored in February and in May of 2010. The first one was called Money Never Sleeps. The second, The Great Reflation, Investing During an Age of Uncertainty. And we'll talk about The Great Reflation first. Let's start with that one and show how this ties into where we are today.
Well, the one thing that when I wrote this article, you got to remember, probably the Great Recession was probably a major shock to the country as a whole, and in fact, globally. At one point in time during the financial crisis, it was thought that the world's financial system was coming unglued. If we go back to the Wayback Machine and you go back to 2009, the financial crisis that erupted during those 2 years, it seemed like the world's financial system was coming apart at the seams. You can recall in fall of 2008, those Monday morning briefings by Hank Paulson, where we had an alphabet soup of various government programs from TARP to TERP to ZERP to even the Fed in March of 2009, ending the crisis by ending mark-to-market accounting and announcing QE1 of $1.2 trillion on the backs of a $1 trillion stimulus by the Obama administration. And so the market began to take off and recover by the summer of 2009. The economy was in recovery mode. We had come out of a recession officially, and the stock market went up that year. And when we moved into 2010, which was one of the reasons I wrote this article, it was called The Great Reflation, because stocks were going up in 2009. It was a very good year for the market. Stocks were going up in 2010. And I wrote about, I said, I know what you're thinking. The nearly 80% rise in the S&P 500 since the March lows of 2009 doesn't make sense. The unemployment rate is 10%. Home foreclosures are at new record highs. Businesses are closing shop or laying off workers. The government is running $1 trillion deficits and backing $1 trillion bailouts. How can stocks be going up under these conditions? It sure doesn't look like a normal recovery. And that was the premise of this article. It was like everybody was saying, we're headed for another crash. And the thing that we were looking at that time is, number one, stocks were at record lows in terms of PE ratios, dividend yields. We were also looking at liquidity in credit that was beginning to flow into the market. And the banking system has always been the centerpiece of liquidity flows. So the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009 produced the deepest economic decline that we had experienced as a country in terms of since 1930. So the mindset and the perception back then was, we're headed for another big one.
Yeah, and you remember, Jim, back then we did a thing called Q-Lines, where we took phone calls from listeners. And back then everybody was wanting to predict when the next crash would occur. In other words, there's always this angst that follows a troubled time, and everybody huddles off in the corner and says it could happen again at any time.
And given the mindset, remember, we had the bursting of the tech bubble between 2000 and 2002. The NASDAQ lost over 70% of its value. And here it was, 5 years later, we went through another major downturn. So in the period of 8 years, we saw 4 years of declining stock markets nearly half the time. And what we were focusing on right then, which is what gave us that confidence to be bullish about markets, is when central banks create liquidity through massive injections. Remember, when they print money, they buy treasury bonds, money has to flow somewhere. Now, the problem is that it can go into two places. It can go into the economy, which is what the Fed was hoping that it would do, boosting economic growth, or it can flow into financial markets, creating higher asset prices. Well, in 2010, we were still going through foreclosures. Banks were foreclosing on homes. Homes were going into bankruptcy. Businesses were still shutting down. And so a lot of people were saying, you know, it's not going in the economy. The economy doesn't look better, even though it was improving. So it's really when you understand that bull markets and economic recoveries are based on money and credit are the main drivers of bull and bear markets. When money is created and credit is created, it moves into the economy and the financial markets, giving us a recovery. When it's withdrawn, it gives us a recession and a bear market. So money and credit drives the business cycle, which is what we were watching. And traditionally, when the Fed injects liquidity into the market, the first place and the first destination of newly created money is going to be in the financial markets, not the economy. Now, the financial market, you know, just turn on the evening news. There's not a newscast out there today that doesn't tell you what the Dow did or the S&P did for the day, because people follow the financial markets. When it's going up, they feel things are better. When it's going down, you know, they feel that things are getting worse, which is one of the reasons why the Fed is propping up the markets as much as they are, laying off doing anything right now that would be disruptive to the financial markets and a presidential election. So when money enters into the financial system, it drives asset prices. That's the first place that money finds a destination. And as that happens, people begin to feel more confident. Businesses spend money. Consumers begin to spend money. The economy improves, not to mention the fact that interest rates are at historic lows in the history of the world. And so anytime a central bank reflates, as it has done in this financial crisis, in terms of really historical levels, we'd never seen, quite honestly, in 5,000 years of recorded human history, have we seen negative interest rates, or certainly interest rates as low as they are today. And I go back to a favorite book of mine written by Jenzo Parsons. It was actually Stephen Marks who actually wrote the book. That was his nom de plume. But he had a comment, and I think that fits so well what we were seeing at that time, and that is, the good effects of an early inflation, the effects at the beginning of inflation are all good. There's steep in money expansion. In this case, the Fed's balance sheet expanded by over $4 trillion. There's rising government spending. The government now spends, $5 trillion. Increased government budget deficit. Everybody remembers the $1 trillion budget deficits. And this year, there'll be $600 billion. And also booming stock markets. You know, the S&P today is around 2160. In March of 2009, it was at 666. So we have gone up more than threefold. When I wrote that article, everybody was questioning an 80% rise. Well, we're up over several 100% since then. So there's this feeling as financial markets begin to rise and asset prices, which is the most effective way the Fed has to stimulate the economy. Because when the Fed creates money, the government has no control where that money's going to go. They can't tell you, well, we're going to create and inflate the money supply, and you got to go spend your money at Home Depot or go to the shopping center this weekend. Individuals make that individual choice. But what we saw was an expansion of this money supply and credit starting to take off, which is what made us so bullish.
And the unfortunate thing, Jim, is that today investors don't have the luxury to sit out, say, for example, in money or money market funds, because as they're sitting there in these times, the value of their money is actually eroding. So they have to do something with that. And you haven't been the only person saying that.
No. In fact, going back to 2010, famed investor Jeremy Grantham was predicting that within the next 18 months, the S&P 500 would take out its historic highs of 1,500 to 1,600. And that actually happened, not in 2010. It actually happened in April of 2013, when the S&P finally took out the highs that were reached in March of 2000 and September of 2007, where we surpassed that 1,550 level. And as we are doing this show this weekend, The S&P 500 is on at 2160. So not only did we surpass that, and but went on to new record levels. And what I talked about in that article, I said markets would continue to benefit from this tsunami of money, while monetary and fiscal injections create distortions in the U.S. economy, leading to a bifurcated economic recovery. And that's exactly, John, what we've seen. We've seen certain elements of this economy do well. Wall Street is doing well. Main Street has not done well until recently. It has only been towards the end of 2014 and 2015 that we got the unemployment rate down to 5% year over year. We're seeing wage inflation up about 5%, which is currently hurting profit margins. We'll get into why stocks are still going up despite a decelerating economy and falling corporate profits. But what we were seeing back then was an increase of money flows that were going in. And not only that, we always know that when you're in a zero or low interest rate environment where the Fed brought the interest rate of the Fed funds rate down to a quarter of a point, people are going to take advantage of it. Now, a lot of investors in the early years from 2009, when the economic recovery began, until roughly about 2012, a lot of individual citizens could not take advantage of it because a lot of them were deep in hawk because they were upside down on their mortgages. So it didn't matter that mortgage rates went down. If you're upside down in your mortgage, you couldn't get a loan. But who did benefit is investors. If you were an investor, why would you leave your money in cash when you can go into the stock market? And I could remember, John, when we were getting 4.5%, 5% on corporate bond yields, we were getting 4, 4.5%, sometimes 5%, and even 6% on dividends such as utilities, some of the oil stocks. And so the biggest beneficiary when this thing turned around was Wall Street versus Main Street, which is why even today, as the economy begins to decelerate again, why there's so much economic angst in this country is because underneath the surface, if you dig below the stock market, the underlying economy is not doing that well and it's starting to decelerate, which is what the media is not talking about intentionally, because nobody wants to talk about, nor would the administration want the media talking about, what's going on in the economy, but we're seeing it with corporate profits. I mean, yes, many companies, we are now getting into Q3 earnings season. Many companies are going to start reporting profits that beat expectations, but the overall trend for 6 quarters in a row has been for declining profits. So the first relief valve of all this money injection that began in 2009 with QE went into the stock market. Here we are on this Thursday with the S&P up at 2160 from the March lows. If you're just looking at price appreciation, the stock market is up 224%. Throw in dividends, it's up over 250-260%. So, you know, the Fed was trying to inject a lot of money into the economy. And that money went into the financial markets. As financial markets rose, people began to feel more positive about the economy. And we did get an economic recovery. We're still in one today, although that recovery is waning. But it did produce a positive outcome. Unfortunately, most of the positive outcome was on Wall Street, which is the result of monetary inflation.
Yeah, one of the other things that I know you've talked about recently has been the flip over we're seeing, especially in the LEI, say, for example, manufacturing reports. You can tell that things are turning.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we were watching in 2009 and 2010 that made us very positive was the uptick in the LEIs. And LEIs are just simply telling you that things are improving, and that's what we saw. However, let me put a caveat there, because one thing that we were seeing in this economic recovery, unlike previous economic recoveries, is we were not seeing the improvement in small businesses. And there's a number of reasons for that. Number one, they just weren't seeing consumers spend a lot of money back then. It was only on the high end, those that probably the Wall Street crowd that was benefiting. On the vast majority of people were not spending a lot of money, because we saw that reflected not only in just the LEIs, but also we saw that reflected in the type of stocks that were doing well, like the large retailers, the luxury retailers, Coach, Tiffany's, stores like that. But it was the lowest business formation that we had seen in any economic recovery since World War II. And that's still a fact that remains to this day. Small business formation has been extremely anemic, just like the economy. And it's another reason why this economic recovery has not been able to get liftoff without any kind of stimulus, which is why 8 years into this economic recovery, we're talking about a federal funds rate that's at 0.5% versus the Fed's original projection when they announced the end of tapering. We were supposed to be above 2% at this point with Fed rate hikes. Here we are, and the Fed has given the rate hike pass 6 times, and it's even questionable if these trends continue, whether they go in December or will they make a monetary blunder. But so we've had, as I talked about in this article, a bifurcated economy. You have one end, the high end, doing very well, the low end not doing very well. And John, it is very much reflected in the economic angst that's being reflected in this economy. One candidate, Donald Trump, is making a big thing about that. He's talking about jobs. He's talking about creating jobs, because a lot of people do not feel that this has been an economic recovery when they look at their own financial circumstances.
And in the article, Jim, you pointed out too, and people need to remember this spans back over quite a bit of time here, since most of the economic growth has actually been the result of fiscal and monetary stimulus, not of actual real things necessarily going on in the economy. That means future growth is likely to be genuinely anemic, and the unemployment rate is going to be high for years, which leaves politicians in the lurch, but it also leaves us with the government or the Fed. That's it.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, we have yet to achieve 3% economic growth in any economic recovery. We're cruising along at 1% now, and the best we've done is 2.5%. And as I talked about in that article, as a result of this government intervention in the economy, government is becoming bigger, and that translates into bad news for the economy, because the bigger percentage government becomes in an economy, the slower the economic growth. You have, best example I can give you is what's going on in Europe and Japan. So bigger government means bigger deficits, higher taxes, slower economic growth, lower productivity, and we have inflation, and we haven't had deflation. On a year-over-year basis, it has not been negative. We've had quarters that have been negative, but we've had inflation because the money supply has not contracted. It's through the Fed's intervention, they've kept that money supply positive. But we've seen higher taxes, more regulation, bigger government deficits, and the result is lower productivity, which also means slower economic growth. So as I talked about back then, the economy will limp along. And what we would do is we run the risk, if this continues long enough, as I was writing back then, is that eventually you're going to get an asset bubble. And some are saying that right now. I mean, if you look at stocks today, they're not cheap. And the forward PE ratio, even on the S&P, is above historical standards. But as we get into the next article that I wrote back then, that money never sleeps, money is going to gravitate to where it is best treated. It is going to look and find a place, whether it's emerging market debt, emerging market stocks, dividend paying stocks, or corporate bonds. It is going to look for the best rate of return, because money does not remain idle. When the Fed creates money, it just doesn't sit there. Somebody's going to spend it. Somebody's going to invest it. And when they invest it, one of the reasons why Wall Street has done so well, think of you as a consumer. If you could borrow interest rates at 0.25%, at 0.5%, how much money you would make. If I could go to the bank and get $1 million loan for 0.5%, I could invest it in blue chip dividend paying stocks and make a return of 3-4%. I can make 10 times my rate of return in the financial markets versus what it cost me to borrow, which is why a lot of these financial firms and the financial system is done well in this environment, because the Fed has kept interest rates artificially low, and you can arbitrage that. You can borrow it at 0.5% and invest at a rate of return that is many times, 10 times more than that. And so that's exactly what is going on right now in this kind of marketplace, as investors look for places to earn better rates of return.
Well, if we go back to that article again, because we're always asking the question, what does that mean for investors? You told them to watch both money and credit, and then also watch the LEIs, because as long as the LEIs were positive, the market was going to be positive.
And that's what we've been doing. We spent a lot of time on this program talking about the LEIs, and one of the reasons that we've been so a little bit more cautious going back to last fall or winter of last year, is the LEIs were starting to soften. They were starting to roll over, and I think they're approaching, in our opinion, they're approaching a peak. We're also watching credit flows. And so as long as money is being injected in the market, and remember, it doesn't have to come from the Fed. We're in a global system. And as, I was talking with Jonathan Krinsky in the first hour, one of the things that we saw, the big worry leading into this summer was Brexit. If Britain exited the European Union, we were headed for a market collapse. Well, what happened? We had stock prices down for 2 days in a row. The Bank of England created $250 billion worth of liquidity. Other central banks added liquidity into the market. And we had some of the best summer rallies. So it wasn't go away in May and come back after Labor Day. And even now, this fall, here we are in October, and it has been a very mild correction at best of 1% or 2%, because what is happening is money is still flowing into the market. And a lot of you may be saying to yourself, well, it doesn't make sense. Jim's talking about the LEIs rolling over. Jim's talking about the economy decelerating. Jim's talking about corporate profits are down six quarters in a row. Everything that he's talking about is a trend that is heading lower. Well, when you talk about the LEIs, we like to break them up into two categories. One is monetary and one is fundamental. That's basically what's happening with business. And right now, the monetary indicators are very positive. And the result is exactly what you're seeing in the market right now, despite these fundamentals that would argue like, hey, why is the stock market going up when profits are going down and the economy is slowing down? It's because money flows or monetary flows are still remaining positive, which is why stocks are as elevated as they are today, despite the poor fundamental economic news that we see.
Well, then the what to do, the action item here is, if we go back to what Jonathan Krinsky was saying, say, for example, in the first hour, he said he was very positive on the stock market. He sees it going much higher. So then what do investors do here?
Well, John, you got to follow money flows. And, you know, we're following the LEIs. The LEIs are definitely decelerating, but we're also watching the monetary indicators. And when they start to shift, that would portend a major shift in financial markets. Right now, the Fed is keeping the markets elevated ahead of the presidential election. As we talked about in the summer and we talked about when we came back from our August recess, I just felt that there was no way the Fed was going to raise interest rates in September, 2 months before a presidential election, especially when they raised it last December. And look what a surprise the Fed got when they saw the result. And the problem with the Fed is these guys are academics, but we're living in a world that operates much differently today to things that the Fed does. The problem that the Fed had, and it soon found out, if you take a look at the Fed policy loop, is what happens when financial conditions tighten? Think back to the fall of last year. The Fed was telling us that we're going to raise interest rates. We're going to raise interest rates. Well, they didn't do it to December. But as a result of them talking about doing it, a number of things happened. You saw the dollar begin to appreciate. You saw credit spreads between sovereign debt like treasuries and corporate bonds widen, meaning that the interest rate on corporate debt went higher. It was a period that we took advantage of in the end of the fourth quarter, the beginning of the year, because junk bond yields got back up to 10%. Corporate bond yields were widening. And so we were able to lock in on some very good yields. So there's a process. The dollar appreciates. Credit spreads begin to widen because people think, well, if the Fed's going to raise interest rates, it's going to be bad for the economy. So there's more risk to corporate debt. The third thing that happened, as we saw, is the VIX widens. The VIX measures volatility, and it spiked at the beginning of the year. The next thing that happened is equities began to fall, and that's what happened. Stocks went down every single week for the first 6 weeks of the year. And then what also happens is the yield curve flattens because investors begin to anticipate a slowing economy or recession, which means long-term rates come down. And if the Fed's going to be raising interest rates, as they told us four times this year, then the short-term end comes up. Now, what happened after that was the Fed reversed itself. And they said, okay, we're going to lay back. And they did that in February. We had the Bank of Japan go to negative interest rates. We saw the reverse condition. The dollar depreciated, credit spreads tightened, the VIX fell, stock prices rose, and the yield curve steepens, which is where we are today. Now, it began to shift again in May of this year, but then it changed after Brexit as more liquidity flowed into the market. So once again, we are watching the LEIs very closely, but we're breaking those LEIs into two components, the fundamental side, which measures the economy, which is decelerating, and the monetary side, which still is accelerating. So as long as that holds true, the market is going to hold up, and it may even change. We'll talk about some possible outcomes based on the presidential election, because both candidates are talking about spending massive amounts of money, which means we could very easily in 2017 and 2018 go back to trillion-dollar deficits as we did in 2009, 10, and 11. So, John, we could be going back to trillion-dollar deficits. Question is, will that happen as a result of a recession, or will they head it off at the pass and preempt a recession by immediately coming up with fiscal stimulus that's backed up by monetary stimulus? I could not see the government spending massive amounts of money, and then all of a sudden the Fed is going to come in aggressively and raise interest rates, because it would counteract and offset everything that the government was doing.
So if I'm picking up right now on what it is you're saying, even though the economic indicators are decelerating, that's pretty clear, profits are falling, and it's sort of evident that we're heading towards a recession sometime next year. Nevertheless, the Fed is keeping monetary conditions positive along with other central banks. It's what you were talking about. It's being driven by monetary policy. So here's what you're looking at. You have economic indicators deteriorating on that side, but monetary indicators are positive. So now how do you behave in this kind of an environment?
I think you have to be invested defensively. You still need to own stocks. You still need to own gold. We're in short-term debt. And then I still think that, you have to have, what anybody else does is you diversify, but you have to keep your maturity short, because we have seen an uptick in sovereign debt. And one thing that's occurring right now that may cause rates to rise, which would surprise the markets, is there is a spread difference between what you can earn overseas on interest rates in Europe, where they're mainly negative, or in Japan, where they're negative, and what you can earn here. So let's say I'm, a European investor or a Japanese investor, and I'm saying, you know what, the difference between the debt in Japan, which is negative, and what I can earn over here on treasuries is 1.7%. So I'm better off taking my money and putting it into U.S. credit instruments, whether it's corporate or sovereigns. But here's the problem. You have to hedge your currency, because if you make 1.5%, but your currency or the dollar falls by 2 or 3%, you end up losing money. And what we've seen now is, because this is a game of debasement between central banks, that's what they're trying to do. The monetary transmission is being reflected through the value of the currency. So if the currency weakens, what happens is you have to hedge against currency risk. And the cost of that currency risk is eating up the profits on the difference between interest rate spreads. So you can have interest rates actually rising, not because of anything the central banks are doing, but because of the volatility in currencies are costing you more money to hedge your currency risk, and it eats into all the profits on the spread in interest rates. So that's why we like things like short-term corporate credit. We still like the dividend-paying stocks of staple companies, which have been correcting as the risk-on trade has gone, where people are going into small-cap stocks. We still like gold. We still like cash. So those are the things that I think you have to be hedged, because, as I have said here, we don't know how this is going to play out. And if anybody tells you they have the answer, I would take a second look, because, quite honestly, all the forecasts, even on Wall Street and in the halls of government or even at the Fed, have gone awry, because this is such a fluid market that can change, just like it began in 2013 when the Fed announced taper, or in 2011 when we were in a financial crisis. So this can all change overnight, John.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Late last year, we spoke with Roberto Aguilera, who's an adjunct research fellow at Curtin University in Australia, on his book, The Price of Oil, which was released late last year and co-authored with Marian Radetzky. A phenomenal book, very well written, and lots of outside-of-the-box thinking with a very important forecast for oil prices for decades to come. And Roberto joins us again today to speak with us about his book, whether or not his forecast is playing out or not. Roberto, let's start out and talk about the forecast that you did give in your book based on the extensive amount of research that you did in terms of production, what we see playing out with shale gas, the twin technological revolutions of hydraulic fracking and horizontal drilling. We're going to go into all that today, but would you mind start off telling our listeners what your forecast is for the price of oil in the decades ahead and how that is playing out?
One of the important subjects of focus in our book was the shale oil revolution and whether or not that would expand internationally. And we said that it would, and that as the revolution developed and expanded, it was bound to have a strong price-depressing impact. And we had a conclusion on prices that was envisaging a level of about $60 a barrel in 2035. And then a more optimistic scenario, which now appears increasingly likely, that saw a price of $40 by then. Of course, this book was mostly written at a time when oil prices were still high at about $100. And then suddenly in late 2014, the price plunged down to around $50 a barrel. That fall took almost all oil analysts by surprise, with official price forecasters like the major investment banks having to repeatedly revise down their forecasts. And we, too, were astonished by the extent of the price decline, or we did expect it to happen, but only after the shale revolution had successfully spread beyond the U.S.
Welcome back to the second part of The Big Picture. Here's an interesting quote. I'm sure a lot of you are going to recognize this. Somebody reminded me the other night, I once said, greed is good. Now it seems greed is legal. That is from the movie Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, came out in 2010. Of course, quoting the personality in the movie, Gordon Gekko. And what he did say is the richest 1% of this country owns half of our country's wealth, $5 trillion. One third of that comes from hard work. Two thirds comes from inheritance, interest on interest accumulating to widows and idiot sons. And what I do, stock and real estate speculation. It's bull. I won't say the rest of the word here. You got 90% of the American public out there with little or no net worth. I create nothing. I own. You know, ironically, it's very true.
And it was funny because when that movie came out, I was seeing this great inflation, as we talked about, coming to asset markets. And what I began when I wrote that article, I said, welcome to the world of cheap and easy money. It's a time where asset bubbles get inflated, deflated, and reflated again and again until the value of money becomes meaningless. It's an environment defined by zero interest rates, trillion-dollar deficits, and currency debasement. It's a world where real values get inflated until value has nothing to do with hard work or the creation of productive goods and services. It's all about speculation. A liquidity-driven market swarming around the globe, looking for returns and a temporary place to land. Such is the beginning of great inflations. And what I was really trying to hit about at that time, John, is a couple of things that were occurring. With all this money creation, it was obvious to us that the majority of that money was finding its way into the financial markets, which were doing very, very well. And at that time, there was a lot of, I would say seers, call them whatever you want. There were all these big gloom and doom predictions of we're going to face a crash is pending. There were things from technical analysis like the Hindenburg Omen, the infamous Death Cross. You know, everything I was reading back then was calling for Armageddon to the end of mankind in the markets. There were calls. One prominent forecaster, I call him Wrongway Harry, was calling for the Dow at 1,000, Dow 500. I mean, there were so many predictions back then to match any kind of psychosis, neurosis, or any other depressing malady conjured up in one's own predisposition to doom. You know, when we came out of the financial crisis, the gloom and doom trade was reborn. It was reborn on websites. The most popular websites out today followed by the public are gloom and doom sites. You know, I can think of one site has been calling for a crash. In fact, a number of them have been calling for a crash, a collapse since 2008 and 2009. Well, we did have a collapse and it happened between 2007 and 2008. But the market, as I mentioned in the last segment, is up 225%. And so there were a lot of these predictions. And of course, to make matters worse, in the spring of 2010, everybody remembers the flash crash. And I remember we were actually active in the market on that day. We had a hedge position on the market that hedged half of our stock portfolio. So when the market had been going down for a couple of weeks, which is what we were following, we were thinking, oh God, this is great. And so we were thinking, okay, time to take off half our hedge, John. We took off half our hedge, and literally within about another 45 minutes, we had the flash crash where the market fell another 1,000. So we still made money, but we didn't make as much because we had taken literally half our hedge position off because we thought, well, the market's down enough. But in a matter of minutes, it went down another 1,000 points. So think of if you're an investor, you're just coming out of a financial crisis. Personally, you might have seen your 401k program, your net worth fall in value, your house fall in value. You're seeing probably the worst financial crisis this country has gone through. You're seeing things that you probably thought you'd never see in your lifetime. You're looking at interest rates at a zero, money market funds at zero, your house, your major asset has fallen in value by 40%. You're upside down in your mortgage. All these things are going on. You're seeing trillion-dollar deficits, the Fed launching quantitative easing, which is a fancy way of saying printing money. All these things are happening, and you can understand why the gloom and doom industry was born or reborn, because it was around at the end of the 70s. In fact, it reached its height, basically the pinnacle, just as the market turned around in 1981. I remember How to Prosper from the Coming Bad Times, a big bestseller back in 1980 or 81. So all of this is in the mindset of investors, which is why there were so many prominent calls for an imminent stock market crash.
Well, but Jim, remember at the time we were taking a lot of flack because you were saying that we should be positive on the market. Let me read an excerpt from this article about Money Never Sleeps. Will there be a crash as the doomsters are predicting? There is always room for a rogue wave lurking in the shadows that could emerge out of nowhere and catch investors and markets by surprise. But the kind of doom that is currently being predicted is going to take more than a large directional trade by a hedge fund. To precipitate the kind of disaster currently called for is going to take another world war, an outbreak of the bubonic plague, Ebola, or a nuclear detonation.
And the reason, John, that we felt that way, number one, stocks were not overpriced. I mean, when you have stocks fall 45%, as they did between 2007 and 2009, that's not when you're going to see a crash, and especially when the vast majority of institutional and individual investors were so negative on the market, predicting the imminent collapse and another crash. And on top of that, we were seeing what was happening with investors. You had two kinds of things that were going on at that time that made us more positive about the market. First, individual investors were pouring into bond funds. Between the market crash of 2008 and 2009, the amount of money that was going into bond funds. For example, when I wrote this article, there was almost $200 billion that had gone into bond funds since the beginning of that year. In fact, since the crisis ended in 2009, half a trillion dollars of individual investors was flowing into bond funds. So investors individually were doing something they had not done before. So anytime in the 90s there was a stock market correction, investors would pour money into stocks. Even after the bursting of the tech bubble, there was money that was flowing into the market. Mainly, it was the real estate bubble, but money was still flowing into stocks between 2002 and 2007. This time around, investors were pulling money out of stock funds. The money was flowing into bond funds, driving down yields. You know, when a bond fund gets a lot of money, as they were getting, they have to take that money and they have to bid up the price of bonds. As they bid up the price of bonds, whether it's corporate or sovereign debt like treasuries, it bids up the price, which lowers the yield. And what was happening since that financial crisis, if you were in a bond fund, you were seeing your dividends be reduced every single year as more money came in. Now, the other thing that we were starting to see at that time was something that reflected what we talked about in the first part of the big picture. Number one, corporations were sitting on trillions of dollars of cash. They weren't building new factories. They weren't hiring a lot of workers. The major corporations weren't. So what were they going to do with that money? So they could do a number of things. They could, you know, basically just invest it in cash and leave it there. You didn't want to do that if you were a corporation, because if you were sitting on a wad of cash, you could become the subject of a takeover. Another company could come and buy you and use your own cash to pay for you. So corporations could either, number one, raise salaries, pay out bonuses, buy back stock, or increase dividends. And what happened is they began to increase dividends, and we saw something that we had never seen before in the technology space. And this gets back to an article that was written in Barron's by Andrew Berry. And he was talking about all these technology companies in the last decade spent literally tens of billions of dollars buying back their stock, only to see their stock prices decline every single year. So Berry was positing the idea, instead of buying back your stock, guys, why don't you start increasing your dividends? And that's exactly what happened. And that's one of the reasons why you're looking at Microsoft, Intel, and Cisco. If it was the year 2000 and I told you you could get a 3.5% dividend yield, or at one time 4% dividend yield on Intel, Microsoft, or let's say Cisco, you would have told me I was crazy. But that's what happened. Companies began to use that cash to buy back stock and raise their dividends. So what was really driving this bull market was not individual investors like the past. It was being done on the institutional side with central banks who were buying stocks. You have the Japanese government that is buying back stocks. You have central banks in Europe and around the world that are buying back stocks. And you have corporations. I mean, last year, I figure what the figure was. It was $500 billion in stock buybacks. And I think this year, the stock buybacks will exceed the record that was set in 2015. So what was driving stock prices higher was liquidity that was coming from corporations. It was coming from central banks. It was driving the markets higher, because what were they doing? They were looking for a better return. If you're a corporation sitting on, and I remember this specifically, you saw a lot of this occur in the year 2013 and 2014. You had companies like Intel. You had companies like Apple that issued five-year notes. I can remember an Intel issuing a five-year corporate note at 1.6%, and Intel was buying back its stock at that time that was paying 4.25%. So they were paying 1.6% to borrow money, and they were buying back stock that was paying out 4.25%. So corporations began to arb their stocks, driving up these stock prices. And, you know, individual investors, I think if you were looking at, gosh, individual investors aren't going into stocks, they're going into bonds, why does the stock market keep going up? And it was the theme of the article, Money Never Sleeps, because corporations, institutions, money is going to find a place where it can earn its highest rate of return. and the highest rate of return was in the stock market. It wasn't in the bond market. I mean, yes, you made some money in bonds if interest rates came down and you were getting a cash flow yield through the dividend. But quite honestly, the dividends on stocks were much higher than what you were getting in bonds. Who wanted to be in 2% treasuries or 1.7% treasuries today when I can still get a dividend yield that's twice the rate of what I could get in the sovereign bond market? And forget sovereign bond yields in Europe and Japan. They're non-existent. They're negative. And who wants to loan money to the government and the government charge you interest to loan the money? So these were the things that were fueling the market that we were seeing. And it's one of the reasons why we felt that the myth that would happen that we were going to face a stock market crash, John, you can't have $1 trillion a year go into the stock market and expect a stock market crash. It's just not going to happen.
So in this article, and a reminder is going back to 2010, you were saying that holding cash obviously didn't make sense, even if you could sleep at night. Remember, we talked about that one gentleman that one time that told me, yeah, I'm in cash. And I said, well, you're losing value right as you look at it. And he says, yeah, but I can sleep at night. Because the numbers were all the same anyway. But in contrary to what he was doing, the best deals were actually in the market. And in addition to the myth, and we kept hearing this, the imminent stock market crash, the imminent stock market crash, inflation was actually a higher probability than deflation.
And one of the reasons why, as the Fed created this money, it did not allow the money supply to contract. And even though, if you look at the way the Fed measures inflation, those numbers have been below, and the Fed has been off its mark on its 2% inflation rate. But if I look at the things that you and I, if you're listening to this program, you're a consumer. If I look at the daily expenses, the things I pay for food are going up. My health insurance premiums have been going up double digits a year. Cable bill, my phone bill, my utility bill, my water bill, all the things that I need, my sales tax have gone up here. Property taxes are gone up. The things that cost me to live have been going up. Now, the things I don't need, what I call discretionary goods, I could buy a TV set cheaper today than I could 5 years ago. I can buy a Blu-ray DVD player. Heck, they're $50. I remember when I bought my first DVD player, it was $700. I could buy an iPhone. All these things are discretionary, and they've been in a deflationary trend. But the other thing that has been in an inflationary trend is the basic cost of goods to live. And also asset prices. Asset prices have been rising. The one exception was between 2011 and the beginning of this year, which have been commodity prices, because oil hit its nadir in February this year when it got down to $26. Gold got below $1,100. And most commodities have been down. But as Jonathan Krinsky and I talked about in hour one, look at the things that are going up now. Oil prices are up over $50 a barrel. You've got aluminum up. You've got all agricultural prices. And one of the things that you always have to watch in markets, what is this telling us about money? Where is money going? What is that signaling to us in terms of a market? And right now, money is looking for yield. It's looking for safety as well. Are you going to park your money in a money market fund at zero or at a bank at 0.5%? Probably not. Would you rather get 2.5% or maybe 2.75% in a bond fund? Probably yes. That's better than zero. Or would you want to be in a stock and getting 3, 3.5, 4.5%? You know, you can't get the same kind of dividend yields that you got 3 or 4 years ago. But 3.5% is still twice what you're getting in a treasury. So when I talked about where money never sleeps, what I was really talking about, that money is going to seek an outcome where it is best treated. And as long as there is a positive return somewhere, money is going to gravitate. It could be going into small cap stocks with the risk on trade that's currently in place and has been since Brexit. It can go into emerging market debt, where the yields are higher, closer to 4 to 5%. It can go into emerging market stock indexes, where those indexes have fared not as well as, let's say, the U.S. markets. And so those are the things that you have to watch in terms of directional flows, where you invest your money.
You know, there's been a big fad of passive investing. You know, you just put your money in some kind of an index fund and sit back and let it happen. You know, when you look at the recovery period, we did well in the first couple of years. 2011, the stock market just seemed to come unhinged. Subsequently, it did okay, but then we seem to be on this sort of a roller coaster type of thing. So isn't some type of strategic investing, or actually what we call a tactical investing, you know, going on the warpath here with what's going on, better than just trying to coast?
Oh, absolutely. I think you have to be very tactical here. You know, there's a time you need to row and there's a time you need to sail. And John, you know, this whole idea of passive investing would be great if we were living in the world of the 80s and 90s, or what was commonly referred to as the Great Moderation. But now we are living through what we call the yo-yo years. You're going to see shorter business cycles. The last business cycle was from 2002 to 2007, then we had a recession. So that cycle only lasted 5 years, versus previously the business cycle would last 10 years in the 80s, 10 years in the 90s. And if we continue to slow down, there's a good possibility that this recovery is already getting long in the tooth. There is a good possibility that next year we could end in recession, especially if after the election, the Fed continues to raise rates. Now, the current theory that's going around Wall Street right now is one and done. In other words, they raise rates in December, they get the Fed funds rate into 0.75%, and then they just back off and remain on the sidelines for the next couple of years. Because the Fed has got to know that if it raises interest rates, how confident can they be on their economic forecast when they're seeing the slowdown in numbers that we are? If we're seeing it, you better believe that they're seeing it with the numbers, and they have access to the data sooner than we do, and probably more comprehensive data than what we have. And how confident can they be after what they saw happen in December of last year? Can they be that confident if they do it again this year? It's almost like they're going to be stubborn enough to say that, hey, we're doing it, we're doing it, we say we're going to do it, well, we just have to do it, and then suffer the consequences. And if we see the same thing happen again, let's say they go in December, and we see the stock market start to sell off towards the end of the year during the Christmas season, that would obviously affect Christmas. If we see the same thing happen at the beginning of next year, where the markets start to go down, because one of the things that happens in presidential election cycles is the first year of a president is when they do all the hard stuff they had to do. Now, Obama, when he came in, was coming from an opposite perspective. We are already in a recession. We are already in a bear market. So he got the go-ahead in Congress to go along for this massive spending program that raised the deficit to $1.4 trillion. And so we don't know what's going to happen in January, but the Fed has got to be sitting and looking at the cycle that it creates. If financial conditions start to tighten, that's why we're watching our financial stress index. We know the pattern of Fed policy loop. The dollar will appreciate. Credit spreads are going to widen. The VIX is going to rise. Stocks are going to fall, and the yield curve is going to flatten. That is the sequence in this global market that we operate in. So there's no way, John, I could see them possibly coming in here and raising rates as they're talking about maybe 3 rate hikes next year. I just don't see it without all kinds of turmoil. So in the meantime, you've got monetary conditions that still remain positive. Money is still flowing into the market with corporate buybacks, not as much. The corporate buybacks have receded recently. Central banks are still buying money. So that is one of the reasons why, as we head into this fall, which typically has been a bad period of time for the markets have remained elevated. We're still at 2160. The stock market is still up 3 or 4% for the year. Not great, but it's positive. And the stock market has produced a better return than the yield that you would get on treasuries. Although the best performing market this year has been treasuries, because we started this year, treasury yields were at 2.25%. And here we are with treasury yields at about 1.7%. So, you know, money is still going to look for a place to earn a decent return, because money never sleeps. It is always going to find a place where it is treated best.
And Jim, I'd like to point out to all of our listeners that you're going to be discussing this much more in depth and other issues that are related to where we are right now. The PFS Strategy Seminar is coming up on October 29th. Why don't you talk about that just a bit?
This is our annual event we put on once a year. This year, the theme of the seminar is called Approaching the Peak. We're going to be talking about, in the first hour, the only game in town. Second hour, we're going to go over what our monetary and economic indicators are telling us, where this market and economy is heading. Third hour, we'll be talking about tactical investing and how to prepare for either outcome. Either, let's say, we get a fiscal stimulus with the new president, which could extend the economic recovery for a year or two before we get into recession, or we get into recession first. We're going to talk about the things we're looking at, as well as some financial planning updates. There's been major changes coming to Social Security and Medicare, also to estate planning and taxes. We'll also be covering that. But all that's going to be coming up on an all-day event coming up on October 29th, the last Saturday, just before the presidential elections. They'll be coming up at the end of the month. Well, John, it is that time. As usual, we've run out of time. I wanted to cover these two topics today because a lot of people have been asking, and we get this, and we'll probably do an on the record here sometime here in the next couple of weeks. We've been getting a lot of emails. Jim, you're saying the LEIs look like they're getting ready to peak. You've been talking about the economy slowing down, corporate profits peaking in 2014, the economy peaking in 2015. Why is the stock market still going up? And so we're going to be covering that. And I wanted to talk about these two articles, which I wrote back in 2010, because this is what we foresaw would happen. Now, I'm probably going to update those articles and append them to reflect what we see now, which is a little bit different conditions than what we were seeing back in 2010. The stock market was much cheaper back then. Dividend yields were higher. Interest rates were higher. I mean, literally, the government was pouring trillions of dollars of deficit spending. The Fed was pouring trillions of dollars of monetary spending. And what we did see was the outcome we've seen since 2009, where the stock market is up over 225%. So this is something we wanted to cover, and we wanted to cover it today because it's going to be a theme that's going to be updated at our upcoming strategic conference coming up here on the 29th. In the meantime, as usual, we're out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.